ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
Hello, Tom Robinson with you. Welcome to the program. I've got the microphone off Matt Brand today. He will join us a little bit later to give us a bit of a preview on what's happening on Landline this weekend. Before 1:30, though, we're also going to visit an avocado nursery just outside Darwin. It's got big expansion plans.
Because we've got the new shade house this year, we've been able to double our production from last year, which is really exciting. So hoping to be able to continue to build year on year.
Also before 1:30, I'll introduce you to a guy who, for some reason, decided to hook up a V8 engine to his chainsaw. More on that later. Interesting decision. Got to figure out why he's done that. We are broadcasting right across the Northern Territory on ABC Radio and the ABC Listen app. We'll speak to the Weather Bureau later. If you have a question, get in touch on 0487 99 1057. Today marks 60 years since 200 Gurindji, Mudborough and Walbury people walked off Wavehill Station to demand better wages and living conditions. Probably know they were led by Vincent Lingiari, and this is considered one of the most important moments in the history of Aboriginal land rights. 60 years to the day, and they actually went on strike for 9 years. It led to the Prime Minister at the time, Gough Whitlam, travelling to Wavehill Station to hand back land, and you might remember that famous image of him pouring dirt into Vincent's hand. The ABC was actually there at the time, filed this report, and just a warning, it does contain the voice of an Indigenous person who has died.
Dagaragu, as it's known in Gurindji, is now no longer part of the Wavehill Station. The Prime Minister spoke.
And I want to give back to you formally, in Aboriginal and in Australian law, ownership of this land of your fathers.
And with that, Mr. Whitlam bent down and picked up a handful of the red Wattie Creek dust and, in a reversal of history, returned to the Gurindjis, the land of their dreams. Firmly clutching the soil, one of the original petitioners to the Governor-General 9 years ago, Mr. Vincent Lingiari, replied. He told the visitors and the men of his tribe who worked the Murrumulla Gurindji Company cattle station that they now had everything. Previously, they'd had bullocks and horses. Some had even had motor cars. But it was the land that mattered.
We're all friendly now. We're all mates. We're all mates.
That whole process started on this day 60 years ago when the man you just heard, Vincent Lingiari, led the Wavehill walk-off. And, of course, in Kalkarindji, on Wavehill Station today, that is being commemorated by the annual Freedom March. Our reporter from the ABC, James Elton, is there today. How's it going, James?
Hey, it's good. Yeah, everyone's sort of relaxing and having some lunch now after the march this morning down on the banks of the river, not far from Kalkarindji.
Yeah, great. How many people came out?
This was big. I've only been once before, which was last year, and this was certainly bigger than that. And people I've been speaking to who've done this many times reckon this is right up there. By my rough head count, I'd say about 1,000 people took part in the march this morning, and there's still people arriving in Kalkarindji for this festival, which will go all weekend, and Jimmy Barnes is playing tomorrow night. Huge. So I think we can expect that crowd to to grow at a fair clip.
Yeah, you'd think. Where have they come from?
Oh, they've come from everywhere. You know, there's all the local Aboriginal people from communities out this way. So your Kalkarindji, Lajimanu mobs, There's a lot of Walpiri people, and the Walpiri, you know, usually thought of as desert people from, you know, down near Alice Springs and Yundamu and places like that. They were the second biggest tribal group after the Gurindji working on Wave Hill Station back in the day. So, and of course, Lajamanu, which is just down the road in relative terms, is lots of Walpiri people live there. So, we got desert people, the Central Land Council's represented, all the way up to there's some people who are down from Darwin, lots of Katherine people. I've seen some familiar faces from my town, Katherine. So the whole, all stretches of the territory here, but particularly those sort of big rivers, Aboriginal communities very strongly represented.
Have you had a chat with anyone from Wave Hill Station? Are they represented today?
I haven't pinned her down for a chat, but I did spy Connie Woods from the modern Wave Hill Station. She's here with some of her kids, I saw. So they're definitely around. And, yeah, last year we spoke to her and she was talking about how they are very keen to work on Aboriginal job pathways on the station, which, you know, is still a big enterprise. It's a big profitable station, so it has the potential to create good jobs for local Gurindji people, and it's something that she was very passionate about. So it'd be good to catch up with her on how that's going.
And I know the sort of the cattle industry and the NT Cattlemen's Association more broadly has flagged that as a priority, Indigenous engagement and employment. Is there anything particularly special? I mean, Jimmy Barnes is pretty special, but anything else pretty special on the agenda for the 60th year anniversary?
Jimmy Barnes is very special. It's been good to see. There's a gentleman here by the name of Kerry Gibbs who has brought a beautiful restored version of the old trucks that were used, similar model of truck, was used by the unionists to help bring supplies in to the Gurindji during their what turned out to be a 9-year-long strike. And so I was talking to Mr. Gibbs, and he hasn't been here in many years. It's quite emotional for him because a lot of the old fellas, he was 14 in 1966, but he remembers everyone really well, and a lot of the older people have passed, so it's an emotional day for him. But it's really cool to see the truck here, and for someone with that kind of long memory, to be able to talk to some of the other survivors who were on the Wave Hill walk-off, elders like George Edwards, who's still here and still going strong. So, yeah, really, really amazing to see sort of people who have that living memory of what happened back in those days.
Yeah, obviously such an iconic moment in, well, series of moments really in Australian history, not just the Northern Territory. What do you got planned for the rest of the weekend, James?
Oh, well, I'm going to go interview a few more people, and later on there's a bit of an exhibition happening at the Karkarindji Art Centre. The art from in this area is remarkable. If your listeners, some of your listeners have probably seen some of it before, but very distinctive style and a lot of artwork almost done from like a satellite view of the country, as if looking down from far above, and those sort of big patterns in the earth and ridge lines and so on. Really amazing artwork. So it'd be really cool to check that out and catch up with a few of the people who produced that art.
Yeah, great. I'm assuming the footy carnival's on again, as it usually is.
Of course, yes. Vincent Lingiari Cup. How could I not mention? I've seen a lot of people proudly wearing their Gurindji Eagles shirts. So, yeah, there are lots of footy to be played as well over the next 48 hours.
Yeah, nice one. James, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
James Elton, ABC reporter out there in Kalkarindji for the Freedom March. It's 60 years to the day since 200 Gurindji Mudbara and Walpiri people walked off Wave Hill Station to demand better wages and living conditions. This was obviously a monumental time in Australian history in response to the Vestey brothers who owned Wave Hill Station at the time. They were refusing to pay Indigenous workers equal wages to the non-Indigenous colleagues. Rob Roy is a traditional owner out in that part of the world. I understand his father was involved in the walk-off at the time. He says the moment was pivotal in Australian history.
It's kind of basically changed Australia in regards to, you know, fair wages and with the union helping out, but more so with those our forefathers and grandfathers before us that pave the way to how we live today. So, yeah, it's very, very exciting, and a lot of people are feeling all that pride at the same time, you know. So, yeah.
What did your old people tell you about what it was like at the time of the walk-off?
Yeah, well, they didn't know exactly what they were. When my parents told me the story, they walked away from how they were treated, how they were, how the living conditions were, and how, you know, how they could improve health. So when they were told they were about to walk off, the old fellow, Vincent and Gary, just told everybody to gather around. I think it might have been 8 o'clock in the morning at the old Wavell station, that he said, nah, I think we had enough. We're going to go. We're going to walk. You know, I think he knew that whatever they or how they were treated, he wanted to break away from that. He didn't want to prove anything. He just wanted to take his people to move so they can do things on their way, on their land, you know. And that's what he did. And, you know, the historic handover was given back by the then late Honourable Prime Minister Gough Whitlam. And then we realised that it was far more better than what he sort of originally walked away from to what we have now.
And what were the living conditions like, you know, for families working on the station?
Oh, it was pretty hard. They're battling out proper, you know, with them. All they had was just tin sheds to cover up what they can cover from the heat, from the rain, from the cold. They had to, I don't know, I guess they just had to work together to improvise how they could keep their family safe and warm and dry. And but it was pretty tough, what they had there. Like a couple of them old people sitting down, when they talk stories when we were younger, they said it was pretty hard and pretty rough.
A lot of the Aboriginal people on the station, they weren't being paid proper wages, were they?
I mean,
they were getting low wages and mostly just like provisions, weren't they? And a bit of clothes and food, really, weren't they?
Yeah, it was actually ration. It was actually ration that they got paid. It was just, you know, a skinned out bone after a beast got killed. They the station mob took all the beef but left a little bit. A little bit of a bone left over. They had rations like flour, sugar and tea. And so, you know, there's no proper wages back then. It's just all ration payout.
And as you say, you know, Vincent Lingiari and his family may not have realised, you know, that this would lead to 10 years later to the Aboriginal Land Rights Act. But what do you feel really, you know, the legacy of that has been?
After the long, you know, 8 to 9 years of wait, they were pretty patient in regards to what they were waiting for, to be given what they you know, didn't expect. But it was the pivotal moment that actually literally changed Australia. He didn't know he was doing that. He didn't know he had the union to help out with what he did, visiting Gary. He fought against all odds. So his story and his legacy will remain, you know, hundreds of years from now, sort of thing. What he's done to not only people of this community and people of the Northern Territory, but it's the whole nation of Australia, because he literally changed the Australian history.
Rob Roy speaking with the ABC's Jane Barden. His dad was involved in the Wavell Station walk-off, which happened on this day, well, started on this day 60 years ago and lasted 9 years before that famous moment when Gough Whitlam, the Prime Minister at the time, poured the dirt into Vincent Lingiari's hand to symbolise the hand back of land, and a real pivotal moment in Australia's Aboriginal land rights history. Rob is also quoted in a story written by Jane Barden, which you can go and find on the ABC News website, where he says that he wants to see more Aboriginal people, particularly young people, working on their land out in all parts of the Northern Territory. Also quoted in this story is the Northern Territory Cattlemen's Association CEO, Romy Carey. She's talking about a program you might remember called the Pastoral Real Jobs Program. For nearly two decades, the NTCA was trying to offer and work on Indigenous employment programs, but they ran out of funding. They were in a partnership with the Indigenous Land and Sea Corporation. That funding is no more, and for a while now, the Cattlemen's Association has been working on getting government grants. Romy Carey also spoke to Jane Barden and explained how important that program was to the industry and how much they'd like to see it make a comeback.
The benefit of that program for our pastoral stations and for our regional communities was that we were engaging a local workforce, providing them with accredited training and pathways for jobs on cattle stations, not just as station hands, but in the vast variety of roles that we have available on property, and assisting them where they may have decided that after coming onto a cattle station that working cattle might not be for them. It was about finding them a pathway into something else, and that may have been civil construction or something, another pathway that they chose. It was an extremely beneficial program for industry. Obviously, workforce can be very difficult to find and retain in our regional areas, and it was extremely beneficial for our communities who were able to come and source work close to home and close to country. And it was a program that we were and we're still incredibly proud of. Unfortunately, the funding for that program through the Indigenous Land and Sea Corporation ceased some years ago now. However, it is still a priority of our membership and our board of directors to identify opportunities for us to have that program funded again and to continue running that program. And importantly, it's a program that we're still hearing from communities who are looking for opportunities for their young people to come in and find work. And so some of those legacy participants remember the program and will encourage people to contact the office. And so where we can, we support them into jobs and opportunities on the pastoral estate now in a much smaller capacity.
And where are you hoping that you might be able to get funding? Like, are you looking to governments like federal or NT government or other sources?
Yeah, absolutely. At the moment, the Remote Economic Jobs Program is something that we had applied to, and unfortunately in this instance we weren't successful, but we certainly are continuing to look for opportunities at a territory government and Commonwealth level to support the re-establishment of that program.
Chief Executive of the Northern Territory Cattlemen's Association, Romy Carey, speaking to Jane Barden from the ABC on the 60th anniversary of the Wave Hill walk-off. Tom Robinson with you on the Northern Territory Country Hour this afternoon. Got a message on the text line asking, why aren't multinationals contributing to the NTCA's, the Cattlemen's Association's, Pastoral Real Jobs Program? We just heard from Romy Carey, the chief executive, saying they really want to get that program back up and running. They ran out of funding for it a couple of years ago. And, of course, this is all in the context of 60 years since the Wave Hill walk-off. So a lot of these issues, Aboriginal land rights and jobs in the pastoral industry, are very much front of mind today.
Well, I'm Roger Steele, and I've been droving a heck of a lot, more times than I really wanted to. I've been with rushing cattle, I've been through the Murrinjay on four occasions. I enjoyed it so much I got into Parliament later to get away from the cattle. I was the Minister for Primary Industry on the very first occasion, and you're listening to The Country Hour.
Terry's also messaged in with a very interesting story connected to the Wave Hill walk-off. So you would have heard, we were talking to the ABC news reporter James Elton, who's out there covering the 60th anniversary of the walk-off, and he said there's a truck that was involved in the whole nine-year process that was used by the unions to support the strike and drive supplies out to the Aboriginal people to support them. This was a Bedford truck, and Terry's texted in, the original truck is now a listed heritage object. It travelled multiple times between Darwin and Kalkarindji, about 19 times in fact. Brian Manning owned the Bedford truck and supported them, and Unions NT recovered it from the jungle in his backyard in Stuart Park. Took a couple of submissions to get it recognised as a heritage object, and it sat at the Qantas hangar for quite a while before it was moved further. Thanks, Terry. I didn't know that. There's all sorts of stories out there connected to iconic territory history moments, like the Wave Hill walk-off. We love hearing from. I reckon our Country Hour audience is one of the best in terms of getting around the history of this place and sharing their memories and stories of it. So always good to hear from you. From you on 0487 99 1057. In some resources news, a major copper project in Central Australia has taken a big step towards production. Construction on the site is due to start soon. KGL Resources has completed $300 million of equity raising for its Jervoice copper project out there on the Plenty Highway. Now, they haven't quite reached final investment decision, but the chief executive, Sam Strohmeyer, says he's confident that'll happen soon.
We've got a couple of key contracts. Just finalising that, making sure that all the schedule and costs and scope are all spot on, and then really taking that to the KGL board and moving through that FID. So look, we're certainly on track for Q3 this year. And I think, you know, a couple of the other key things that are happening in the background is that the long lead items have been ordered for the plant, and we're sort of getting on with activities on the site as we speak. You know, following the completion of our $300 million equity raise, you know, essentially we're fully funded now to bring Jervoice into operation. So we're just sort of letting people know that, you know, things are starting to happen on the site. One of the key sort of pieces in the announcement is that we have, you know, signed a contract with Northern Transportables out of the NT for the accommodation village and the associated infrastructure. So, you know, it's a combination of we're fully funded and things are actually starting to happen on the site, which is, you know, great for the KGL team, and I think, you know, great to have another mine getting going in the territory.
Let's talk about that accommodation village for starters. 180-person capacity accommodation village for this site. What can you tell us about that, and what can you tell about the workers who will be using it?
Yeah, so it's a combination of some refurbished rooms, which we're getting sort of a little bit quicker to sort of get going quicker, plus the 180. So it's 250 in total, and that'll be sort of installed over the next sort of period of time into next year. Really, it's about, you know, it's the village that we'll need to support the construction activities and then into operations. And it's it's located in a lovely spot on the site. Will be a sort of a modern camp with the sort of expectations you have on a new sort of mining FIFO camp. It's great that we've been able to sort of partner with a territory company, with Northern Transportables. So it's really it's one of the keys to being able to start a mine. You've got to have somewhere for people to stay while we're building the operation, and then obviously as we get into operations as well.
Now, you mentioned FIFO there with this accommodation on site, just for in terms of the people who will be working at the mine, you know, when it is in production, will it be primarily fly in, fly out workers from elsewhere in the country, or will there be local employment opportunities?
Oh, look, I think there's going to be lots of local employment opportunities. It will be a FIFO site. You know, it's sort of, you know, it's 400 kilometres from Alice Springs, so it's too far to drive in and out. So it'll be FIFO, and I think, look, you know, there's lots of opportunities to recruit locally. I think it's, you know, if you're based in Alice Springs, it's going to be a very simple short commute. But we're still sort of working through that.
You're now saying it's fully funded. What does that mean in terms of, you know, actually getting stuck into some mining? What are the timelines we're looking at here?
Yeah, so just a couple of key ones. So for the remainder of this year, it's that early works. It's getting the sort of preparatory civil works going. It's getting crushing plants up and going for aggregate for concrete. Then we really start building the plant at the beginning of next year. I mean, one of the beauties of Jervoice is it's a high-grade copper deposit. So it's not a large plant to make meaningful amounts of copper in concentrate. So it's a relatively straightforward build. So it's construction starting in earnest beginning of next year. We have mining starting halfway through next year, and then sort of construction completion of the plant really sort of in the early beginning of 28, sorry, and then first ore and concentrate being produced in the first half of 28.
KGL Resources CEO Sam Strohmeyer speaking to Charles Geary.
Evenings with Spence Denny.
The very first commercial compact disc was produced in 1982, and that was a recording of Chopin waltzes performed by Claudio Arrau. Did you have a means of playing?
That's a really good question.
See, I'm trying to think when they started to appear on radio stations, and I'm going to go with 90, 91, something like that, before we really started to see CDs in a radio station.
On 105.7 ABC Darwin.
And on ABC Listen.
Hello, my name's Tyson. I work at the What I See Farmers, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
It's Tom Robinson with you on the Northern Territory Country Hour this afternoon. We'll hear from Matt Brann later in the program, and we're not too far away from the 1 o'clock news, but before I send you there, just have a quick little update for you about a company that was behind a very ambitious prawn farm project in the Top End. It's parted ways with its CEO. Seafarms told the ASX today the employment of the chief executive, Peter Fraser, has been terminated by the company with immediate effect. You remember Seafarms is behind that $1.5 billion prawn farm plan on Lejeune Station near the WA-NT border. Of course, it never happened. And in 2023, it went into voluntary administration and the project was liquidated last year. Seafarms says a guy called Rod Dyer, who has been working as managing director on a casual basis, will expand his responsibilities to subsume the CEO role. In this statement, the company says Rod Dyer is being paid $440 an hour. More recently, the company was taken to court by shareholder entities associated with Jan Cameron, who's the founder of Kathmandu, the retail chain. It's alleged the company engaged in misleading or deceptive conduct. Seafarms denies this. That court case is ongoing. We're very close to the 1 o'clock news now. We'll speak to the Weather Bureau after that. And a little while later, we're going to head to a commercial avocado nursery just outside Darwin. They've got big expansion plans. Exciting times for the hort sector. I'll be back with you soon. It's time to go to the newsroom.
Yeah, Gary Riggs, Lakefield Station. Just changed the bore pump, motor, and yeah, you listen to the Country Hour.
Tom Robinson, even with you on the program this afternoon. Thanks for listening. I have got the mic off Matt Brann today, but we'll hear from him in the next half an hour or so. Also before 1:30, going to take you to an avocado nursery just outside Darwin. It's got big plans for expansion.
Because we've got the new shade house this year, we've been able to double our production from last year, which is really exciting. So hoping to be able to continue to build year on year.
What do you get when you cross a V8 engine with a chainsaw? You get that. I'll introduce you to the guy who decided that that was a good idea in the next 25 minutes or so. A few more texts coming in about this truck that's been taken out to Kalkarindji for the 60th anniversary of the Wave Hill walk-off. This truck was essential. It was supplied by the unions, NT unions at the time, to help the Aboriginal people with their 9-year strike and support them through that process. Alex Nelson's texted in saying that he was a member of the NT Heritage Council that approved the moving of this truck to Canberra, of all places. So it was a heritage-listed object, but there was nowhere to preserve it in Darwin, so it was donated to the museum in Canberra to honour the 50th anniversary, 10 years ago, of that Wave Hill walk-off. Thanks, Alex. Do love hearing your stories about territory history. It's a bit of a special interest of mine and the team here at the Country Hour, and reckon our audience get around that pretty hard, to be honest. It's great hearing from you on 0487 99 1057. Let's get the weather now with Sally Cutter from the Bureau. How are you, Sally?
Good afternoon.
There was some rain, wasn't there, in Central Australia lately. We're in for a bit more?
Yeah, we're in for a bit more. We've got a cloud band that's extending across the southern parts. It's just starting to rain in Alice Springs, but there's been a little bit of rain around the area overnight. That band will sort of hang around until probably tomorrow afternoon, and then there'll be a little bit of a break, and then we'll get another cloud band developing on Sunday, late Sunday, and mainly out in the Leicester area, but that could bring some fairly good sort of widespread rainfall, particularly out through that western parts of the southern half of the NT.
Okay, and through the weekend into Monday?
Yeah, through into Monday, then sort of clearing off and then we may see, and to, well, might hang, so things are really, so keep on changing. We'll clear off during the Tuesday, Wednesday should be fine. Then we might see another one coming back on Thursday, Friday.
Okay. And further north, we've had some fire bans and sort of high-risk fire conditions, or conditions that make the risk of fire, bushfires, quite high. But that's kind of eased in the past day or so, hasn't it?
Yeah, the fire dangers have eased, the winds have eased off. We're starting to see that moisture coming back in. So that's reducing the fire dangers. The Bushfires NT is still watching and working with on that one in the Barkly. So there's this, just because the fire dangers have eased, it doesn't mean that there's no fires out there. But just be aware that they are there. But the fire dangers have eased a little bit.
No, of course, and we are in that sort of high-risk part of the year for bushfires now coming into it. But did I see some rain in the gauge in the top end this morning?
Yeah, there was one at the Adelaide River Dirty Lagoon, which, looking at it, it appeared yesterday, and it just seemed a little bit odd because there wasn't much cloud around.
Yeah, right. What happened?
Just okay, because they're tipping buckets, just occasionally something can cause it to tip. So it's a bit like a seesaw. With buckets on the end, so one fills up one bucket, it's a bit like somebody then sits on the seesaw and it goes down, empties out, and the other bucket fills. And then that gets up to, for the NT government ones, 5.5 of a mil, or for ours, 0.2 of a mil, it'll tip back.
Yeah, okay. So something funny's happening.
You've got something standing on there trying to balance. We quite often see these tips to around about 9 o'clock, and there seems to be another peak for about midday. But they generally only ever do sort of 0.2 of a mil.
Okay, so sceptical on the idea of rain out there.
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. What's the forecast like in the top end into the weekend?
Possible fogs. Winds easing, which, and the combination of the two, mean the humidity is going up. As far as the daytime temperatures go, it is certainly warm if you're away from the coast. So that's probably one thing to keep an eye on. So coastal Darwin, we're looking at 33s. But if you're inland, say down at Bachelor, you're looking at 34s. The Humpty Doo is 35s, right through until we get to 36 next week. So it's, and then if you head down further inland, down towards Catherine Way, we're looking at a top of 34 there, or 34, 35 for the next week. Jabiru, 35s, maybe some 36s next week. Maningrida, 31, Nullumboy, 29. So you can see the coastal areas are where you want to be. And if you're on the eastern side, or sorry, the western side of the top end, Wadair 31, Tiwi Islands 33.
And for any fisher people out in the community, should get a wind forecast, I guess.
Okay, so winds over the weekend, if you're on the west coast, so 10 to 15 knots. Easterly winds along the north. Double check I've got 10 to 15 knots along the north coast. Might see some 15 to 20s, but so easing off to 10 to 15 for Sunday. Gulf Carpentaria, we're looking at around about sort of 10 to 15, maybe up to 20 knots today, but then we'd looking at 10 to 15 for the weekend. And if you're well inland, as I said, you're going to get some rain down through the Laster, so we're looking at 20 for tomorrow for Yulara, and then 25 for Monday, Tuesday. On Sunday we could see rainfall sort of 7 to 20 millimetres. So if you are out that way, that's where you're going to see the biggest rainfalls. Across in the Simpson District, Alice Springs, 18 tomorrow, 20 today, then climbing up to 25 for the weekend. And they're only going to see sort of about 3 to 10 millimetres, or think 3 to 15 millimetres. So the further west and southwest you are, the bigger rainfalls you're going to see.
Thank you, Sally Cutter at the Bureau.
That's okay.
Spend your weekend with Lorella Cousins.
LC, what's with the whistle and the watering can?
Gardening Gains, DG.
Oh, is that what this 12-month subscription to Gardening Australia is for?
Yep. You and me,
Jingley Water Gardens Eco Fair Saturday morning for the gardening games plus prizes.
Live music.
Live gardening talkback.
Mulch.
And talking about landscaping.
Weed management.
And the birds and the bees.
Hot.
From 6am Saturday morning on 105.7 ABC Darwin.
A commercial avocado nursery just outside Darwin is expanding. They just provided their first batch of trees to what could be the territory's first avocado farm. And there's more on the horizon. Horticulturalist Ali Hayward has been developing tropical avocado varieties first produced by the late Chris Nathaniel, who was a big-time friend of the Country Hour, as I'm sure you'll remember. Earlier this year, Ali got some funding to build a new shade house, and I went along to check it out.
Yeah, so we have completed the project, which was building the shade house. We're now busily propagating, so we received our next round of avocado fruit, which we get from down south, which contains the seed, which we grow for the rootstock. So we received that back in May, and we've processed all of that seed. It's now, most of it's now over a foot tall and needing to be potted up. So we're currently potting all of that up, and very soon it'll be ready for grafting and away we go. We've been able to, because we've got the new shade house this year, we've been able to double our production from last year, which is really exciting. So, yeah, we've got about 400 seeds for rootstock this year.
What's the full capacity of the shed?
We added it up to be somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 trees for the nursery. So hoping to be able to continue to build year on year. So this is, you know, the first little step of hopefully many.
Of course, this is a continuation of the work that was done at Tropiculture. Remind us, what are these avocado varieties?
Yeah, so we've got Calypso, Macmillan's and Stilla. So these are all varieties that Chris Nathaniel worked on at Tropiculture for many years. So these are all tropical avocados. We've still got the research orchard in Bees Creek. So a lot of the existing old trees are still there. And these are trees that have proven to fruit well up here.
And last time I was visiting, the floodways were full of water. It was a cloudy day. I think it did rain at one point. We were right in the middle of a huge wet season. Has that impacted the construction of your nursery and the work you do in any way? Did it set you back?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So the we were supposed to deliver on the grant, I think it was the end of April or end of May, and we weren't able to do that because of the wet season. We couldn't start construction. So they did extend the grant period for me, which was great, and we were able to get the shade house finished. I think it was by the end of June. It was a very big push to get the project done in such a short space of time because we had all those delays. I couldn't get machinery in here, obviously, until it had stopped raining. Which pushed right out into, as you know, into like April. So yes, it was a big push to get it done, but we're really happy with the end result and really excited about what this means for the next steps. We're having our official opening next weekend with all of the Tropiculture, the old Tropiculture gang are coming to help me warm the shade house. So that's pretty exciting.
No, that'll be great. Do you want to take me to some of the trees now? What are they doing at this time of year?
Yeah, so like I said, we're busy potting up a lot of the rootstock. The avocado trees themselves that are in the research orchard are busy starting to flower about now. Flowering is really gearing up. We've seen a bit of a strange season with the avocados in the orchard this year, probably because of our wet season, how big it was and how prolonged it was. The parts of the orchard did actually go underwater during the wet season, and as a lot of people know, avocados do not like wet feet. So we had some trees die. We had a lot of trees just stagnate, basically, for a few months. They just freaked out and just didn't do much. We've also seen a little bit of early flowering. We've actually got some fruit set on some trees already, which is a little bit unusual for this early in the season. But by and large, most of them are now just starting to push out their good flowers.
And of course, these plants are much younger. They're not at that sort of fruiting point yet. So you're busy propagating. Do you want to come over and show me some of the techniques you're using?
Yeah, so avocado are fairly tricky to propagate. So we graft them all. Usually we just use a wedge graft. Some of the varieties have more success than others, and I'm still trying to work on ways that we might be able to get a better success rate. So I'm trying a couple of different techniques, using some budding just to give it a go. I've got no idea if it'll make a difference, but you know, just trying a few different things. We're also going to set up an area with a bit of extra shade, so some really heavy shade that we will put our newly grafted avocados under to try and really baby them, because that has, in the past, that has seemed to make a bit of a difference. So yeah, we're just trying a few different things to try and get a better success rate, to make more avocado trees for more people.
And this is one of your McMillan's variety here that you're budding on. And just for the audience, who are obviously only listening to this, can you describe what we're looking at on the tree?
Yeah, so this is a tea bud that I've tried. So I've removed a bud from the parent material, so from the tree that was is mature and flowering and fruiting age. So I've taken a single bud off that, and I've inserted it underneath the bark of our rootstock. I've then very carefully wrapped some plastic around it to try and retain the moisture in there. And now we keep our fingers crossed and see if it works.
So it's a bit of an experiment, and you'll see how you go. Have you sent? Last time we spoke, you were supplying a grower who was aiming to become probably the first avocado farmer in the Northern Territory, or certainly in the top end. Have you supplied trees?
Yeah, yep. So he's received his first 30-odd trees he's got, which are now in the ground. He's certainly the first grower up here of these tropical varieties of avocados. He himself is trying different things. Like, he's open to a bit of experimentation and trying to get as much as he can out of these plants. But yeah, so they are safely in the ground. We've got another 30 odd growing on for him, which will be ready in the next few months, and the rest will be coming as we get some good propagation happening.
I guess what comes next for you? Expansion?
Yeah, well, that's right. Just trying to build on numbers. If we can get the propagation down to a finer art and get a better success rate, then we'll be away. So that's one thing that I'm really keen to try and improve on. And then upping numbers of avocados each year, because a lot of people, nearly everybody, wants an avocado tree in their backyard. And like I said, these are tropical avocados. They fruit well and they taste amazing.
Ali Hayward speaking to me at a commercial avocado nursery just outside Darwin in Acacia Hills.
This week on Landline, restoring healthy waterways in southeast Queensland. Riverbanks are being repaired and hotels for freshwater cod introduced to encourage breeding.
You can't just put fish in water and they're going to live. We've got to address the reasons why the fish became extinct in the first place.
That's Landline, Sunday, 12:30 on ABC TV and streaming on ABC iView.
And of course, the market report with Matt Brann, who is in the studio now, fresh from Kidman Springs. But you've also been looking at grain prices this week, Matt. What's going on?
Well, grain prices are on the up, is the short story, Tom. So since July, the benchmark Chicago wheat futures price, it's gone up by 20%. That is significant. It's gone up for a few reasons. The main one, though, is the war between Russia and Ukraine. It has really intensified over the last few weeks. So they have been bombing each other's grain terminals, and a lot of this aggression and bombing is being done using drones. So they're attacking each other's terminals, each other's ports, ships trying to leave the Black Sea carrying grains, they've been attacked as well. I was told by a contact this morning that 97% of Russian and Ukrainian export capacity out of the Black Sea basin is now offline. So that is essentially grain exports out of the Black Sea have come to a halt. I spoke earlier to Nick Crundall. He's from MarketCheck. Says a lot of buyers are now turning their attention to other countries like Australia.
So what it means for Australia is it's a good news story for Australian grain producers. So it's good for our pricing. So what's happening right now is if you're sitting in Asia and you're an importer of wheat, they were buying it out of the Black Sea because the Black Sea is in the middle of their harvest or at the back end of their harvest. They are the cheapest, and that's where they get it from until Australia hits their harvest period. They've obviously been taken offline, so we're seeing them come to Australia. So exporters based in Australia, the GrainCorps, the Cargills, the CBHs of the world, are seeing inquiry from these consumers around the world, basically coming to them and saying, hey, I was otherwise going to get this out of the Black Sea. We're going to need to get out of Australia. So that increased demand into the export market means they're having to come into the local markets, bid the price up to basically cover those sales they're making.
So that is Nick Crundall from MarketCheck. If we look at Aussie grain prices, premium wheat over in Western Australia is now up to $380 a tonne, which is good money, $360 a tonne in Victoria. For the cattle industry, all this matters as well. You think of those big feedlots over east, they're forking out pretty decent cash to get hold of cattle at the moment. The national feeder steer indicator is back over $5 a kilo, which is pretty decent. So they're paying decent money for the cattle, and the cost of grain to put down the throats of those animals, it's on the up as well. So perhaps a little bit of pressure on the feedlotting sector.
Get all the details this weekend on Landline. Thanks,
Matt. Absolutely. And thank you for hosting the country out of that. Appreciate it.
Anytime.
Hi, I'm Raylene Brown, and I work in the bush foods industry in Central Australia, working with some amazing ingredients like our beautiful kwandongs, wattle seeds, bush tomatoes. Wow, I love them, their little tangy flavour. And you're listening to The Country Hour.
It's Tom Robinson with you on the program this afternoon. How good's your chainsaw? Is it that good? Doubt it. South Australian farmer Glenn Simpson decided his chainsaw needed more power. So he built a very special edition using a V8 car engine, which you just heard then. Elsie Adamo went to have a look and asked him what prompted this unusual project.
We're renowned for doing things a bit out of the box in Keith at the Keith Show Society, and or the Keith Show Revved Up, we call it now, because we blended the Keith Diesel and Dirt Derby with the Keith Show for one event a year. And we like sort of things that people don't do in other areas or other districts. So I saw on Facebook or YouTube or somewhere this, I don't know, I think it was in America somewhere, like V8 chainsaws. I thought, oh, that's great. So I Googled it, found a bloke in New South Wales to bring one across to the Keith Show. And he said it was too hard and couldn't come. And I thought, oh, I've started this now. I'm going to have to build one. So then the challenge began.
How difficult was it to build?
It was a bit tricky. Originally, I was going to build two, a Ford and a Holden one, so, you know, have a bit of a race. But it was a bigger job than I thought, so I was just stuck with the Holden one at this stage.
Like time-wise?
Well, after work, weekends, and a bit of work time.
Don't tell anyone.
No, I don't tell anyone. So, no, it was all good fun. But rounding up the parts and get a few niche parts made and stuff. So, yeah, it was good fun. Probably took 6 months to build it. So, like, obtaining engines and, you know, right-angle gearboxes and a bit of lathe work and, yeah.
Have people been surprised that you went to the effort to make this?
Yeah, they think I'm mad. But it's fine. It's fine. It's cool. It's good fun. Kids love it. Adults love it. People go, why? But, lots of noise, lots of fun. Yeah.
So, explain a bit about what it is.
Yeah, it's obviously a chainsaw. So, we got a Holden V8. And obviously you don't run a radiator or anything like that. And we take all the gearbox off and put a right angle gearbox on it. And we got forestry harvesting machinery, like the blade, the bar and the chain and the sprocket, and adapted it to the V8 chainsaw. So we cut pine with it. Oh, we've cut a bit of harder wood, but and it's all a bit of fun and it's a lot of noise.
What are its uses, Glenn, that a normal chainsaw can't do? What can you do with this
one? Well, we did cut a few big logs at the Keith Show for the fire buckets, but obviously with no radiator, you can't cut for that long. It gets a bit hot, but cuts very quickly. And it's a bit of a piss take. You know, it's for shits and giggles, really, for laughs. And people go, why? Why not? Yeah. So, you know, we've got a couple of V12s in lawnmowers and stuff, so the next challenge might be a V12 chainsaw.
V8's not
enough. No, V8's not enough. So, no, we love it. It's just fun. And we had the other traditional hot saws at the show, then we threw the V8 chainsaw in amongst that for laughs, and it was, yeah, great fun.
How's the interest in it been?
Oh, it's been huge. People love it, and people go, why, really? The kids love it. So, yeah, puts out a fair note. We made sure we had some nice extractors on it, and, yeah, for the V8 lovers, it's really great.
It seems to have a few limitations that a normal chainsaw doesn't.
Yes,
maybe
you can't lift it.
Not quite as mobile. Yeah,
not quite as mobile. Yes, it's sort of like, yeah, hinged on it, on the wheels, obviously, because it weighs so much.
Yeah.
But some of them have two blokes that lift them, but we wanted to make it so that one person could operate it.
So what have you been using it for mostly?
Well, the workman told me off because when I first built it, every time I walked past it in the shed, I started it up. They said, you got to stop doing that. It was going to be worn out in no time. So, no, it's for fun, pure fun. If people come over on a Friday night or a Saturday, we start it up and cut a bit of wood for them.
Has anyone been asking to borrow it?
No, and I won't lend it either. Probably a bit dangerous too. Hey. Yeah, so it's just another little niche thing for our key show.
South Australian farmer Glenn Simpson speaking to Elsie Adamo about his V8 engine chainsaw. We're almost out of time on the Country Hour this afternoon. It's been good to have your company. I've had the mic off Matt Brann, who's back in the hot seat on Monday. Make sure you're tuning in for another full week of all the best rural stories from across the Northern Territory and the rest of the country. If you've missed anything, be sure to listen to our podcast on ABC Listen. I'll let you go for now. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.